The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
She threw some sawdust in the air and her hands began to shake. She told me the town where I was born. She almost knew the date. She lit a candle with her eyes, and then she made the table rise. Now, all of this is sounding like parlor tricks. I mean, these are something that probably any magician worth their salt could probably do. And the reason I say it like that is that he just kind of said, oh, yeah, well, she did this, she did this, she did this. But he's not talking about his reaction to that. So far, he's not overly impressed with what she's doing. Okay, yeah, you can throw sawdust. Yeah, you know where I was born. Maybe that's a big deal. Maybe it's not, etc. She took the dollar from the jar and then she guessed my weight. Now, this is funny to me because here we are. She's being metaphysical. And then all of a sudden she guesses his weight of all the things that she could be prophesying or predicting or seeing that which is not immediately obvious. Okay, she guesses his weight. So I thought that was interesting. And then also she guesses his weight only after she takes the money from the jar. So I'm wondering, is there any significance to that? Or was he just being poetic in continuing the narrative? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that's all about kind of the drama, the scene that he's creating and that the method that a fortune teller uses to kind of create the mystery or the aura to make one believe they really can tell the future or they really know all these things about you, where really guessing your weight isn't such a big deal. But at this point, because like I said, he's kind of maybe in a hypnotic state because of the surroundings and the tent, it's all kind of mysterious. So this is, I think, kind of the drama or the techniques that might be used to kind of keep you roped in. So it's just kind of the excitement of being in there with the gypsy. And like I said, at this point now, she's kind of got him in the palm. Just like if you go to a revival meeting or something, you know how people are just kind of like, oh, yes, 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 we get it, we got it. So maybe it's kind of the theatrics of that that create the mood and, again, keep him in that kind of like, I don't know, vulnerable state of what are you going to tell me?
You know, I think of it being sort of like a verbal breadcrumb, kind of, okay, I'm going to give you a little bit to keep drawing you in. And those are fairly mundane things. But if she's accurate about them, then he's going to be, okay, tell me more, tell me more. So I think you're right on with that. You are so old, you are so wise. Now, that is interesting because I didn't know who was talking there. If it was the fortune teller who was talking, it's almost a cliche for her to be saying this. We talk about these days, well, somebody is an old soul, you know, whatever that means anymore. If it's him talking, it's implying that he trusts her. I mean, you're so old, you're so wise, you got my weight right, you got my birthplace right, so let's keep going. It sounds like it kind of resonates with what we've already said about him trusting her to tell him more. Would you agree?
Yeah, that's interesting that you said, is it her talking? I never considered that it would be her talking. I always thought it was Gordon because now she's got him in the palm of her hand.
And no pun intended.
Yeah, right. And that, but now he's giving her the power. You're so old, you're so wise. So he's kind of giving her the power over him to give him a sign, you know, tell it to me, like he says in the next one. So I'm ready. Tell me what you got to tell me.
It's a great way of continuing the narrative. I really liked that. When you were a child at school, they taught you quite a lot. And this is another thing that's fairly obvious. He did not have a complete education at that point. And the limits on formal education when he was growing up, and this would have been in the 50s, I suppose, in the early 60s, not everybody went to college. Not everybody got a higher education. And you could make a perfectly decent living without a college education. Whereas now in the 21st century, it's almost indispensable. You really are not going to have a whole lot of economic mobility if you don't have a college education. You were taught to read and write to take your lessons home at night. And I'm thinking, yeah, well, didn't that happen to everyone? Everybody is taught to read and write in the United States and Canada, okay, and to do their homework. But again, it sounds very mundane. I don't know what your experience was like, Carol, but when I was younger, I couldn't get excited about learning because it was all rote memorization. And
that's exactly the word I had. Yes, rote. Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, I'm kind of giving you a peek behind the curtain. We know so much more about learning and education than we did 60 years ago, 50 years ago. So that's why they tell us, beginning teachers, don't teach your kids the way you were taught, in that we know so much more now. A little knowledge serves you well, but the golden rule does not. And now this one, it's still stuck in my craw. Who is not well served by the golden rule? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I also thought of the biblical phrase, I think it's in either the Proverbs or Psalms, that say a little knowledge puffs up. So what is this little stanza about? A little knowledge serves you well, but the golden rule does not. Help me out here, Carol.
Well, of course, I don't know exactly what he was thinking, but again, now the gypsy's telling him what he was like as a child, which wouldn't be too hard to see if she was good at reading people. But now Gordon's reflecting, and I believe you talk about education, you know, the rote learning, not everyone fits into that. I'm sure Gordon was probably one of those students who didn't fit into rote learning, because it sounds like from a very young age, music was his path. And so that probably didn't fit into the type of education that he was getting in school. So here's just this innocent kid. I get the feeling that his parents were very loving, that he had good parents, probably pretty innocent. So when he went to school, all of a sudden he realizes he's not going to fit in. And then you learn a lot of other things when you're in school, and you learn that not everybody's always very kind, whether it's other students or teachers. So maybe the golden rule he was talking about was referring to that, that when you go out into the real world, golden rule doesn't always serve you well, because you might be treating other people the way you were raised, but not everybody was taught that way. So it's not going to serve you well if your teacher is slapping your hand because you couldn't remember something, or they used to hit children in school. I don't know what his experience was like, but I was lucky I didn't have those, but I do remember being humiliated in school, or I do remember kids picking on me and hearing kids call each other names, or, you know, hear about bullying in school. That was never talked about back then. So I don't know if that's what he was referring to. School wasn't the way it was taught back then, probably for somebody like Gordon, who was on a different plane, didn't really quite fit in. Your good, kind upbringing maybe didn't really work out so well with other kids or other teachers.
No, I think you're right. And I think he may very well have been a victim of his own innocence, his own naivete, his own upbringing, because not everybody had that upbringing. And teachers back then were kind of, if they were taught anything at all about psychology, it certainly were not told, don't humiliate a child. And nowadays, that's another thing that they tell us. Don't get into it with a kid, because nobody's going to win. That's a lesson that we have to learn as educators. There's nobody who can tell us that, I think, is the point that I'm making. We have to learn that on our own.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
Did you know we have a full podcast series that walks through Bob Dylan's entire professional career? It's great for newer fans, or anyone who wants to take a thoughtful tour through the last 60 years of Dylan. It's called A Bob Dylan Primer, and it's a 16-part serial. Find it at fmpods.com or anywhere you listen to podcasts.
One minute, you're a teacher preparing for the new school year. The next, you're transported to a fantastical realm shrouded in forgotten magic. The creatures around you think you're a long-vanished mage, You have no technology. You have no memory of how you got here and no idea how to get home. All you have is misplaced magic. Haladar, The Last Surveyor is the new fantasy novel by acclaimed author Rob Perrier. Available now on Amazon.com and RobPerrier.com.
Then when I came home that night to lie awake in bed, I thought of that old gypsy and the words that she had said. And now I see with due respect, the more we learn, the worse we get. This is kind of a James Joyce style epiphany. And I guess I'm wondering what he learned from the gypsy, or what has he learned at any time that is going to make him worse? Or on the other hand, is he talking about having learned that gypsies really can't read fortunes after all? Because this sounds like he is maybe questioning himself. Why did I bother doing that? Because I didn't really come away with any answers. Do you have any thoughts on what's going on here?
Well, I really love the last part of this whole song. It's starting with that verse, because whether the gypsy told him anything directly or not, the bottom line is going to the gypsy made him do some self-reflection. So he might have given the gypsy some credit. But if, again, we were, you know, as we go through that, and all she said was deedly dum, deedly dee, she's not really giving him any direct answers. But what she did was cause him to start going internally for some direct answers. And the direct answers came from himself.
And I think that was probably, if nothing else, it made him thinking about, and I'm not a gypsy. I don't plan on becoming a gypsy or a fortune teller, but I've certainly been with enough people who said something in whatever context that made me think about my own condition and decisions I had to make, or improvements I had to make in my own conduct, my own way of living. And then he finishes up, "So if you feel you've no regrets, go have your fortune read." And what I'm thinking about is that if you have your fortune read, it's going to make you think, either self-reflection or self-examination, or it's going to make you think you're going to have regretted having parted with your money and wasted your time. But it sounds like what you're saying, Carol, is that it's going to make you realize that there are things in life that need to be rectified and that you need to reflect on and change. Am I hearing that right?
Well, this is my favorite line, the clincher line. So I guess the question, when I hear that last line, I think after listening to the rest of the words in the gypsy, I think to myself, all right, what is your biggest fear about going to get your fortune read? My answer would be, well, they're going to tell me that I'm going to die. That would be the worst thing, right? You're going to die soon, or you're going to get cancer, and you know, something terrible is going to happen to you. I guess the way I look at this, especially now at this point in life, if you've lived your life with no regrets, meaning you've consciously gone through life, you've tried to do the best you can through life, you've tried to live within a certain moral code, tried to, you know, set your standards and not stray from them. So if you've lived a life like that, now if your gypsy tells you something bad's going to happen to you, you can say, you know what, I don't have any regrets. If my life is over tomorrow, I'm good with that.
That's a great way of looking at it. And it maybe is urging people to try to avoid having regrets, or to look back at things and say, wow, I wish I had done that. When my father passed away, my mom was as philosophical as she could be after 40 years of marriage. But she said, I'm glad that there were a lot more, wasn't it great that we did things, as opposed to don't you wish we had done things. So that's what came to mind when you were talking about it like that. Well, the song did appear on Back Here on Earth in 1968. This was his fourth original album. That was the 10th track. It was the fourth song on side B. It was not released as a single, but I have seen it as a B-side for the singles to Early Morning Rain in 1969 and 1971. I've never played that record. I don't own that record, but I've seen it as a B-side. So somebody liked it enough, thinking, okay, well, we need a B-side. Let's put it on there. It's on the B-side of the record anyway. Maybe nobody's going to listen to it, but gives a little bit more exposure. The album went to number 21 in Canada, and that was the highest he had done in the Canadian charts so far, or tied a different record. It didn't chart in the US or the UK or Australia or New Zealand. So it was a record that, as we look at it, it certainly wasn't anywhere close to the best he was going to do, but he was moving up at least with his Canadian audience. So we've now chewed on the lyrics quite a bit, Carol, so we need to probably look at the musical elements a little bit. For me, I loved the guitar harmonics. And for anybody listening that doesn't know what that means, it means that you put your finger on a guitar string and you strike it, but then you lift your finger up at the very last second. And we hear that a lot in the song, and it sounds a little bit like a xylophone, but it also sounds vaguely like that, those pump organs that they used to use on carousels. So that to me is bringing this idea of the circus home a little bit more. So is there a particular part of the music that you particularly enjoyed?
Well, what I really like about it is the clean finger picking that he does. Rhythmically, it's solid. He doesn't miss anything. It's steady without being rigid. And the harmony, it has ringing harmonies. And as Jimmy Buffett, who was a huge fan of Gordon Lightfoot, says in his song, Rue de la Guitare, he mentions a line in there. It says, playing a D18 played Lightfoot clear. And I think that this song is a good example of Jimmy's line, playing Lightfoot clear. I mean, that's what I think he was really good at. And I think when I first started listening to Gordon, it was the guitar playing along with his voice, which was very strong, that kind of roped me in. So I think it's got all of that in that song, The Gypsy.
You mentioned Jimmy Buffett. That's a pretty good authority on what sounds good as a professional musician. God rest his soul. The album only had three people on it, Lightfoot, Red Shea, and John Stockfish. So it's the original trio that had been with him since the original album of Lightfoot, which was recorded back in 64 and then released in 66. So there were no guest musicians that I know of, and I can't hear anybody other than the three of them on this song. So there's no cameos that I can figure out. And again, you said it was very straightforward. It was clean. And Red was being, I don't want to say conservative, but he certainly wasn't trying to outshine Lightfoot with his fills. I think it was the harmonics that really did it. He wasn't doing anything like, okay, let's do a guitar solo here for 90 seconds, because he didn't need to.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
The American West is a place of lore and legend, of triumphs and tragedies. No one can tell the true stories of the West better than author Rick Stieber. And now there's a podcast showcasing his work. It's called Writing the West, and every episode will feature his short stories and his poetry. If you want to know the true stories of cowboys, pioneers, miners, and Native Americans, this 15-minute podcast is for you. Writing the West is available on Spotify, Audible, Podbean, or wherever you get your listening matter. That's Writing the West, the work of Rick Stieber.
Have you checked out the Dylan Taunts? It's a podcast full of smart conversations with interesting Dylan scholars, academics, and fans. Find it at fmpods.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Lightfoot only played this song once in concert, and it was in May 1968 at Elmira High School in Elmira, Ontario, Canada. Kind of a shame, because I think it could have been very good in concert. But then again, it may have been one of those situations where Red is saying that I can't recreate that effect on stage or something like that. Do you have any ideas about why it was played so seldom?
I don't know, because there are so many of his songs that were played so seldom. And I think that's unfortunate for the audiences, because there's so many tunes that so many people don't even know exist. I mean, even the current band members will tell me, I don't know that song. I never heard that song. So I think it's too bad that there were so many of those tunes that weren't played in concert, that being one of them.
Yeah, and we'll never know why he made the choices that he did, except, again, as I've said before, you got so many songs to choose from. Obviously, he didn't have as many to choose from in 1968 as he would in 2008, but he certainly had no shortage of good material.
Being the perfectionist that he was, I'm guessing that if he didn't feel he could perform it on stage in a way that brought him satisfaction, he wouldn't do it.
Covers have been done. These are the ones that I could find, have been done by Petula Clark on the Come On Home album, Neil Chotem in the Gordon Lightfoot Instrumental Songbook, the Johnstons on the Give a Damn Bitter Green collection, and then Jimmy Buffett, as you said earlier, did in Buried Treasure Volume 1. I don't know if I've missed any covers, but is there anybody that you would like to have heard do this song that hasn't or didn't?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't like to hear anybody do a Gordon Lightfoot song other than Gordon. But I will put a little plug in for the Lightfoot band and their new singer, Andy Mock, who has joined the band. And I know Andy personally, and I have told Andy, you're the only one that I give 1,000% endorsement to do Gordon tunes, because Andy has been an ardent, devoted follower of Gordon since the early 70s. He knows all those tunes. They're all heartfelt, and his voice, of course, that isn't Gordon's voice, but it does the music justice. So I don't have any problem with Andy doing Gordon's tunes. So no, there would be nobody else I'd want to hear do Gypsy other than Andy Mock.
There was one person that I would love to have heard do it, and it's someone who has covered at least a couple of Lightfoot songs, and that's Dylan. I think this is the whole gypsy circus thing. I think it just fits with his 60s mystique, particularly mid-60s, maybe heading into the John Wesley Harden ideas. I would have liked to have heard him do that, but at the time that this came out, Dylan wasn't really interested in doing anybody else's music. Later on in the early 70s, he's going to do Self-Portrait. There's going to be the Dylan album, where he's going to do covers, and he'll do very occasionally, he'll do a song that was written by somebody else. But I think if it had been the Dylan of 1968 or 1966, 67 would have been fun to hear him do this, not the Dylan who's now pushing 85, because I just don't think it would be a fitting tribute. But back then, I would have liked to have heard that.
I think you're right. I think Dylan would have been great on that tune.
Yeah. Carol, as we're sort of finishing up here, anything else you want to say about the Gypsy or about your experience with and alongside and following Gordon Lightfoot?
Again, I just would say that I'm grateful that Gordon was born, that Gordon was able to do what he did. He's taken me through every phase of my life. My children have grown up on him. I guess one example I'll say, there was a time in my life where I was particularly depressed, and I remember my 16-year-old son, because I was sleeping in late that day, which I normally didn't do, my 16-year-old son coming into my room, instead of bringing me a drink, instead of bringing me a prescription antidepressant pill, instead of bringing me a joint, he brought in my boombox and put in a Gordon Lightfoot tape and said, "Mom, you need to listen to Gordon Lightfoot because you know he makes you feel better." And I thought, as for a 16-year-old kid to do that, I just, that kind of like made me like, okay, I got to get out of bed. That's what my kids saw, what Gordon did for me. So I always said that was my drug, Gordon Lightfoot.
Well, good way of saying it. And kudos to your son for being that prescient. about knowing what his mom needs. Mm-hmm. Carol Navarro, thank you so much for joining me. I hope that you continue to enjoy listening to the podcast, and we hope to have you back on the show again real soon.
Well, thanks for having me. And yes, I hope you continue doing the podcast, because you're the only one that I know of where you can tune in and just talk about the words. Not many people can do that. So thank you.
And thanks for listening, everybody. If you like this well enough to listen to the whole thing, tell somebody about it. Carefree Highway Revisited is on Apple, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your listening matter. I'd like to make a special request for you to visit my Patreon page. I love this show so much, and I want to keep it going, and you're in a position to help. Please head over to www.patreon.com/carefreehighwayrevisited. A dollar or two a month is all I ask. You can reach me, Mike Messner, at teachermike72@gmail.com.
Well, our next episode will feature my guest, Deb Radwan, one of the longest listening fans of the show from Southern California. And she and I will be discussing Ode to Big Blue from the Don Quixote album. And that episode will be coming out in January 2025. Until then, for Carol Navarro, this is Mike Messner reminding you, run for the roses, but don't forget to stop and smell them. We'll see you next time.